You're listening to About Buildings and Cities. Our Patreon's at patreon.com/about_buildings, where there's bonus content with every episode.
You have to pay, though, $3 a month. That's $1.50. That's a pound, slightly over a pound, a bonus episode. Very reasonable for the power user.
If you're thinking about it, don't hesitate.
Yeah. Aren't we worth it?
All right. You rejoin us for the second part of our discussion of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
The film by Stanley Kubrick.
Yes. From 1968. And when we last spoke, we were in a kind of hurriedly made excavation on the surface of the moon, surrounded by an unearthly screeching.
Yeah, everyone was trying to hold their ears, but they can't hold their ears because they're in a space helmet.
Not good. Bad vibes.
Bad vibes. It was all very claustrophobic.
Yeah. I mean, this is another one of things that most people would think twice about doing to a feature film audience is like a prolonged
long screaming noise.
Period of like very high-pitched sort of tinnitus-inducing ringing noise.
Loud as well. This is back in the days when they didn't mind a film having high dynamic range.
But then we cut and then we got another title and it's Jupiter Mission.
And we're outside in space again. And isn't it? Spaceship's coming by. This huge, long spaceship with a sphere at one end and sort of rocket propulsion and a long stick in between them. Which, incidentally, I think was an enormous model. I mean, enormous, like, tennis court sized. I think one of them was like 56 feet long.
Nothing would surprise me. Nothing would surprise me. We've not even got onto the most excessive of all of the sets, although we're going to encounter it very soon. So a Jupiter mission, this long spaceship. There are these sort of pods going all the way down the kind of cocktail stick, joining it all together, which I don't know what they are. These sort of triangular,
ambiguous pods. They would have thought about it for ages, about what all the bits were. But I'm not sure the viewer has to.
So the centerpiece of this interior is this amazing another revolving torus.
But much smaller.
Which was built, like, the whole thing was built as this amazing revolving stage set.
Yeah, the size of a Ferris wheel, really. Not a huge one, but it's a revolving disc, which is probably a few metres wide, like 4 or something. The notion is it's spinning around part of the, along part of the length of the spaceship, and that generates gravity. I think, in fact, you'd get a terrible nausea from the tidal force that would be exerted between your feet and your head, because it's very, like...
Oh, God, yeah, because it'd be much stronger. Yeah,
really different gravity. And there'll be all sorts of other funny effects as well.
We first encounter it in this amazing scene where... the thing is, David Bowman, who's one of the two crewmen, is jogging around the track of this quite narrow torus. And he's going all, and this essentially the set is revolving as he's doing this, and he means that the camera kind of gets closer and closer to him, and then he sort of goes over it, and then it like turns around, and you lose him behind the hub of the spindle, and then he reappears again. It's this crazy kind of hypnotic,
yeah, but what you
nauseating.
Is that he is walking around this sphere, and something that we haven't really mentioned, but it's going on all the time, is that the camera angles are strange. Throughout, whenever we're in space, part of the disorientating feature is that the camera will be rotated, all sort of yawed and pitched in a funny direction.
It's a funny mixture, isn't it? Because at one level, he loves and often tries to create these very, very symmetrical, very, very centered compositions. Yeah. But then having created that centrality, often you'll then be off by 90 degrees or something, which only kind of enhances the weirdness.
Yeah,
the
it's
weirdness.
All very strange. And it's very strange to see this guy running around this ring, which, as you say, is created by just the ring revolving. But it works very well. You don't, unless you're really thinking about it, experience that.
And then it means there's the strangeness of all of the furniture sitting on this floor, but which is continuously curving. And there's kind of furniture, but then there are also these eerie and like foreboding inducing coffins.
Yeah, sarcophagi or possibly like an Iron Maiden, but in white, again, shiny powder coated material, high gloss.
I remember these really giving me the willies the first time I saw them, which contain some of the these crew members who've been put on bored in a state of hibernation, which is a pretty classic space travel trope.
Again, it's difficult to know how futuristic this was at the time, but I think probably very. And everything in the interior is white, and everything is curved, and everything is sort of pearlescent white. The floor is like high grip.
It's an astonishing piece of like ingenuity, because the set is complete. It's closed. But somehow they always have to get the camera in. And it's very ingenious how they managed to do it.
Well, I think it was two halves that came apart and went together. So I think it was two drums that split apart.
I've heard somewhere that sometimes they had to, like, sometimes there was no cameraman. There was just the camera, and the actor would have to turn it on at the start of the take, because they couldn't fit the cameraman in anywhere.
I mean, it was made by Vickers, Armstrong Vickers, which was a big, at the time, British defence contractor.
Yes, he was at this time hard at work on the Vulcan bomber, is that?
Yeah, which was the sort of most technologically sophisticated of our it's a big flying wing nuclear bomber. Yeah, like at the technological forefront.
Yeah, the V-Force.
The V-Force, yeah. No, it's Avro Vulcan. So it wasn't built by Vickers. It wasn't Armstrong Vickers. I don't know if they built one of them. They may have built the planes were the Victor, the Valiant, and the Vulcan. You can check if any of those were built by Vickers. Or we could not. They didn't build the Vulcan. The Vulcans were built by Avro. But they were doing that sort of thing.
Yes, Iron Maiden's Iron Lungs, I thought. There's some. Yeah. There's this sort of eerie thing, and you they have a slot across the eyes, so you can just see that there's a person in there. Yeah. It's horrible. It's really... Yeah.
And these amazing terminals everywhere, which are black and either consist of a screen, a television screen, or a set of sort of primarily coloured buttons. The innumerable gadgets. But that's essentially what the interior is. It's just... And there is a few pieces of furniture, desks and chairs, which are all built in and are all made of the same homogeneous white, slightly glossy material.
Yeah, it's such a tight curve. You know, so you have, there's a sort of console, but from one end of the console to the other, it's really curving right down and up. You know, it must cut, like, it sort of, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's very strange and also incredibly kind of carefully thought out. And unlike the first space station, which felt very empty and felt very like sort of prestige space, didn't it?
Although this one again it's not like a submarine or something, which is probably what it would be like. It's not full of places to sleep. It's not like the space station. No. You know, for the one of the Neuromancer episodes, we put up a picture of the space station, which is just full of
wires
junk,
everywhere, yeah.
Stuff everywhere.
No, this everything is here, it's all behind panels.
This is so... It's such lovely industrial design. It feels like you're in the inside of a really premium 1970s photocopier or something.
And in large part, that's because, of course, all of the systems are kept running by...
By HAL, our supercomputer.
HAL 9000.
Who's a red sort of light on a portrait black rectangle. And talks in a very calm computer voice and seems quite mad.
Voiced by Douglas Rains, and it's, this wonderfully strange, kind of subtle, flattened affect.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
Yeah, this kind of slightly passive, I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that, yeah.
It's very memorable.
Yeah, amazing performance. And, there's very, I think, like... For very well worked piece of exposition where they have to do this interview with this ludicrously plummy BBC interviewer,
on BBC 12,
and who then of course introduces the fact that the ship is run by this supercomputer.
Yes, it's very reminiscent of like this is what Red Dwarf is ripping off, and they have the same BBC interview where it's like. But instead of asking, as they do in Red Dwarf, what colour tie was this sports commentator wearing in the 1976 FA Cup final? And he goes, maroon with a...
There's a bit which I think must be another joke where they go, there's a 7-minute time delay, which we've edited out of the interview. And then you see the interview and they go, hello, gentlemen, how are you? And they go, we're fine, thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's incredibly really long... like vapid interview, and you're like, honestly, did they wait for 7 minutes between like really?
So that's the third week. I think it's good to do the joke spotting because all Kubrick films have jokes in them.
We spoke with Mission Commander Dr. David Bowman and his deputy, Dr. Frank Poole. Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. How's everything going?
Marvellous. We have no complaints.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, and I'm sure that the entire world would join me in wishing you a safe and successful voyage.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And then, yeah, Hal actually is interviewed and has the most to say and is very sinister. Talks and just says, like, I'm, to all intents and purposes, perfect and incapable of error, I think, is the...
It's quite good because he's a heuristic algorithm computer. Both words that have stayed in. And heuristic sort of implies the possibility for error.
By definition. It's highly approximate, yeah.
Yeah, definitionally error-driven. I think they probably would have known that. The fallibility of technology, that all the technology is very fallible, is always in the background of everything here.
We're still slightly in the world of like amazing technological demonstrations, though, because there's the chess game, the computer playing chess on this like little tiny monitor.
Yeah, and it quickly beats him. This is a classic. That's in like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, where there's the first automaton beating. I've come across. There's a bit where there's a magical chessboard which beats.
Oh,
beats
amazing!
Him. It's a very old trope, the like strange object beating you at chess. There's a paranoia about the chess. If you want, I haven't looked. Luke's done a lot of research into the paranoia around this. I haven't, but there is one about the chess, which is that it's the chess game they're playing is a 1910 chess game, and it's correct because he was a chess nut. And it's correct that he's lost the game, but there actually is an alternative where he can postpone the checkmate for another 3 turns or 2 turns or something. And Hal, again, has not revealed all of the information. But the crew member just accepts it because he knows that Hal is perfect. I'm not sure you can possibly be meant to appreciate any of that.
No, but the obsessiveness of Kubrick's kind of obsessiveness means that you can never say that it's not freighted with some kind of meaning, can you? You can believe almost anything of it.
There's a very definite bit where he's reading a newspaper earlier on in one of his stages of transport, and the newspaper he's reading has got an article which you can't even, like, even on friend of the show Chris's ginormous television screen, I couldn't read the headline, let alone the article. But the article, if you can zoom in enough, I'm trying to find it in this book. Airliner missing over Atlantic. 2,304 on board. Little hope for Mach 3 aircraft. And it's all about how a technical fault has caused a supersonic airliner to crash.
Foreshadowing.
But you couldn't possibly read it, but it is there in Amazing. The New York Times. Yeah. As soon as the HEPCOM-11Z4 lost contact with the entire system was alerted on the grid comp system in Oslo, and the computerized census control was initiated, including warm-up time for the entire operation took 47 seconds.
So there's a whole fake story.
Yeah, which is written, like, sort of replete with acronyms. And it's about this unexplained technical fault bringing down an airliner. I don't think going into any of this stuff really improves the experience of the film, because actually I think it detracts from the real strength, which is the mythic quality.
Yeah, and the sense of an incredibly fully imagined world, I think.
The sixth member of the Discovery crew was not concerned about the problems of hibernation, for he was the latest result in machine intelligence. The HAL-9000 computer, which can reproduce, though some experts still prefer to use the word mimic, most of the activities of the human brain, and with incalculably greater speed and reliability. We next spoke with the HAL-9000 computer, whom we learned one addresses as Hal. Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
Parker Penn's did a spec for their pen saying that it would have a neutron accelerator, which would oxidize the paper underneath, so it would be used without the use of ink.
Oh my God, yeah. That was a bit the days of like nuclear. You were going to have a nuclear powered cooker. Like, I think there is like a real, there's a real news story about a nuclear powered cooker.
Yeah, or possibly a nuclear ramjet in your car.
Yeah, nuclear. Well, there were going to be nuclear powered elevators in Frank Lloyd Wright's Mile High Tower.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's all possible.
Yeah, it's not clear that it would have made anything better. So yeah, there's a long period of kind of life on board the Discovery, with Dave and Frank, who are the two who are awake. Chess game, bit of sort of sunbathing in some way. There's the birthday message from the parents.
Hilarium. Yes. Yeah, yeah. There's some minor problem where he's not getting enough pay, and they are so robotic. The two crew members are utterly machine-like in their delivery, going about their daily life. But all of this gives terrific opportunity for you to see one of them sitting upside down eating the most disgusting looking lunch. This is the worst lunch.
Oh yeah, there's different coloured mush, and you eat it with the sort of strange stick.
Yeah, and the mush is like, it looks like peas porridge with gelatin in it, in different colours. Oh wow, I've got the picture of the meal tray, by the way, with the Tetra Pak like nozzles, and they're fish juice, corn juice, carrot juice, chip juice, strawberry and orange juice, cheese juice, and coffee juice.
A balanced diet.
Yeah.
Ah, so good. I love this. It's so fun. This is wonderful, and it's, yeah, it just makes it.
It's the perfect balanced diet. It's fish and chips, cheese, peas, and coffee.
And coffee, yeah. I mean, there's a moment which is the moment when something starts going wrong, which I really think is wonderfully undersold.
Oh, can I do one moment before that? There's a good moment before that when they're watching this BBC Channel 12 thing. They're sitting in a seat. They've got a desk in front of them. They've both got their big iPads, and they've both got their TV dinners, and they're both watching the telly on their own iPad, sitting next to each other, which is nice. It's just a nice moment.
Very prescient, isn't it?
Like, they're both sitting right next to each other, watching it on little screens in front of them, having their disgusting lunch. But you're right, there's another moment. They've been having all these weird, extraordinarily banal conversations with Hal.
Yeah, everything is very banal, and it's just happening in this completely surreal environment. And then I think, yeah, it's wonderfully undersold how this is done. So David is amusing himself by doing drawings. The drawings, they're not his, but they're quite good. They're the actual concept art for the film.
Which, yeah, that makes sense.
Which is why they're really designer.
They're really like felt tip. You know those graphics pens?
Yeah, thick line, thin line, sort of inky wash. And then he goes to Hal, says, "Can I look at your drawing?" He shows them the drawing.
That's Captain So and So, isn't it? The likeness is marvelous.
Hal goes into this weird, like, goes like a bit gossipy and starts talking about this being strange things about the mission. And then goes into this, which I think we'll just play this little clip.
By the way, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
Well, forgive me for being so inquisitive. But during the past few weeks, I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
How do you mean?
Well, it's rather difficult to define. Perhaps I'm just projecting my own concern about it. I know I've never completely freed myself of the suspicion that there are some extremely odd things about this mission. I'm sure you'll agree there's some truth in what I say.
Well, I don't know. That's a rather difficult question to answer.
You don't mind talking about it, do you, Dave?
No, not at all.
Well, certainly no one could have been unaware of the very strange stories floating around before we left. rumors about something being dug up on the moon. I never gave these stories much credence, but particularly in view of some of the other things that have happened, I find them difficult to put out of my mind. For instance, the way all our preparations were kept under such tight security, and the melodramatic touch of putting Doctors Hunter, Kimball, and Kaminsky aboard, already in hibernation after 4 months of separate training on their own.
You're working up your crew psychology report.
Of course I am. Sorry about this. I know it's a bit silly. Just a moment. Just a moment. I've just picked up a fault in the AE-35 unit. It's going to go 100% failure within 72 hours.
And but the conversation before that's really strange because he's gone, like, Hal is being really weird and gossipy, and the man is like, this is my psychological evaluation, isn't it? Of course it is. It's brilliantly prescient, the thing of, like, the buffering time.
Yeah, because it's so important, the natural thing would be to really signpost it in a big way, or to make, and it's the most undramatic thing. It's like looking at the spinny wheel on the computer, but everything is happening.
Yeah, it's, yeah, just a minute. And the computer says there's been there will be, at some point in the future, a minor fault with an antenna array. And they've got to go out on a spacewalk. I think this is before one was done. The first one was done by a Russian in the late 60s.
The first one was done in 1965. So it would have been around this time, yeah. Alexei Leonov.
He had a very bad spacesuit. The Russians generally, I mean, the early spacesuits were terrible. They were basically the things that, the compression suits that, they're given for fast jet pilots to stop them passing out.
They have to go out in the little pod. This is a scene which is repeated many times, going out in the little pod, this funny little spheroid with robotic pincer arms.
It's a sphere with a window at the front, and it's got these arms, and the arms on either side, which are both like T-Rex little arms, and they come out, and they've got two at the elbow. They come out to two arms, which makes them look very weirdly unhuman, and they're like little krill arms or something.
Oh, yeah, well, arms within arms.
Yeah,
which is apparently... So I read something with Marvin Minsky, who was doing kind of AI research at MIT at this point, saying that he'd shown Kubrick these early fractal diagrams that they'd been working on of recursively branching images. And this possibly is the source for this particular design, I mean, because it is sort of what it is. I mean, we have another amazing control room. So Dave is in the control room and Frank is in the pod.
The pod room is fantastic as well, which has got all the we probably don't need to go into all of it, but there is another amazing set there of where the pods and the spacesuits are kept.
Yeah, and there's a sort of rather unlikely method where he just does this like enormous space leap out of the pod for no particular reason to go and like jumps across the Gulf of Space to go and fix the thing.
He's got a rocket pack on his spacesuit which allows him to fly.
This is a bit which I'd forgotten until I rewatched it recently, was that they bring back the supposedly malfunctioning component and there's the scene of them trying to fix it.
And it's completely fine.
But again, this has some really great animation. Like digital graphics, screens.
It rotates and rotates in the other ground.
Yeah, and you see these like, maybe I can call it up because it's really cool and I'd completely forgotten about it. It's
because all this is so slow. The action is so slow and you're really in place. You don't have as many kind of keys to remember all the scenes by. What there really are these amazing sets.
Yeah, you see it's sort of these very, very fast flashing images of what look like sort of etched circuit boards at different scales in different colours. And it goes like this incredibly fast slideshow. But it's just the colours are amazing. The sort of, he kind of moves this funny scanning tool around and then he'll like press it and it'll go like...
Yeah, I thought what that might have been was a reference to, early, not PCBs, but early, well, I suppose it's true of both, integrated circuits, the lithographic masks were drawn by hand. So you would literally, and the way they were, you're basically making a huge acetone-like slide, projector slide, and then putting that physically into the projector, and that would create your photographic resist. And so they'd have these layers and layers and layers of, you know, the whole build-up of however many layers of diodes and metal on top.
Right, so he's kind of diving through the kind of the leafs of...
But there was already the technology to, like, flick through loads of layers of resist masks, which were like these sort of complicated diagrams. And so that, I think, was a graphic that would have existed.
And then things light up and strange enigmatic... acronyms come up.
The technology is always, you never, like, it always just works. There's no, any of the infrastructure of the technology is always minimized. What you always have is a screen interface or a sound interface, and everything is magical.
Oh, it's really tense as well. But again, everything, I think, yeah, it really, I think the wooden, the kind of this very sort of stolid performance that they both give, I think really works with the tension, because they don't react to anything.
I mean, what's the, like, if there's a bomb under the table, all the conversation, however boring, becomes interesting? The more banal the conversation, the more tense it is, because there's this, and it's like that, yeah. It's the opposite of, if it's getting a bit boring, have a man walk in with a gun, which I think is Raymond Chandler.
I mean, also true. Also,
yeah.
Also true. But there, we're kind of building to this moment of tension, which is that there's nothing wrong with the device.
Yes, and this is really, you think this isn't very problematic, but it means that Hal, who is perfect, is not perfect. Yeah. He's not telling them something. Yeah. And there'd been lots of clues that all is not completely as... Yeah. It's a bit strange.
Yeah, they, in order to like talk in secret about it, they go in, there's this famous scene where they go into the pod, yeah, and like shut it off and turn off the audio link to Hal. So that Hal can't hear them.
I'm a bit worried about the computer, and it would be terrible for it to jeopardize the mission. Should we switch it off?
Yeah, we would have to disconnect him, and then
you see from the outside, you see their lips moving, and you think, Hal, he's a smart cookie.
Uh-oh. And then it's the intermission.
Screen goes black. Intermission. Ligeti.
More Ligeti. More black screen. It's good, it kind of calls people back in. Yeah.
Yeah. So 15-minute interval. I hope you've all enjoyed your sandwiches.
Yeah, go and do a bit of washing up or whatever. And we've got to do it all over again. Out in the pod, put the thing back in. They've agreed with Hal that they're going to put the device back in to allow it to fail. Then they'll find out what's wrong with it. And then what you see, he's jumped out, but you see behind him, the pod is now moving on its own. Yeah. And it moves towards him. And again, there's a cutaway before you see anything happening. But you see, you're then in David Bowman's perspective, and you see, like, Frank shooting across the sky with his air hose cut, and he's, like, frantically trying to...
And he's spinning and tumbling, and it's very quick and soundless.
So sinister, yeah.
And he just tumbles and tumbles.
There's a thing, there are like these shots of the outside of the ship around this time, and they've done a thing which is completely unrealistic, but sort of tells you that something going on, where suddenly the sunlight is different. It's gone kind of yellowish and crepuscular. It's no longer like bright white.
But again, there's been lots and lots of this very slow balletics of things moving in space, which just continues to build the tension of strangeness and alienation.
So while Dave has to go out and... he goes out in the pod to collect the body.
He manages to get it and sort of pushes it in using the arms of the...
And I think all of this is filmed in slow motion. It gives the whole body this strange sort of floppiness.
I think it must be sped up for the bit when he's tumbling through space. Yeah. And then sort of the other way. Anyway, they're playing with camera speed. And the body is sort of ushered back. And then...
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
This is a bit of a strange one, isn't it? How would Hal know that he would leave his helmet in the spaceship room?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a funny one, isn't it?
It's weird. Anyway, he's not got his helmet and he's stuck in his pod and Hal won't open the door.
And this is the point where Hal also kills all of the hibernators, which is
really sinister.
This is so horrible, yeah. This scene, which again, this is another one where essentially it could be done with stills. There's no movement at all. There's like long shots of...
With a little hum. The pod. Like little sort of fan hum.
Yeah, the noise. And then there is this kind of computer graphic showing their vital signs slowly being extinguished.
And you get intertitles, which go... Life signs terminated. But nothing is happening. It's just graphs. It's just the silent extermination.
Yeah, and this horrible, like, claustrophobic presentiment that the sort of Iron Maidens produced initially is, like, wholly fulfilled.
It's really evil. It's really evil. It's really strange. You can see his real talent... It's real talent for really uncanny horror coming out here, which is going to do very well in his next, well, two of his next three films. Hal's not very perfect, you know, where he could have just, like, vented all the atmosphere out of the ship or something, which is a sure way to... He hasn't taken account of the escape airlock. Dave manoeuvres the craft round and basically, without his helmet on... jumps into the escape lock. There's a great scene of him. I presume they must have like had the escape lock vertical and
Like he has to fall down into it. Yeah,
yeah, and then he sort of bounces around.
there's a funny interview with Keir Dully, the actor, saying, "I managed to get it on the second take." Or he was like, "I knew I could. I knew I didn't want to do too many takes of it because he was obviously going to get really badly hurt.
He's just being dropped down the cylinder, basically, and banging off everything.
And apparently, on take two, he managed to grab the handle, and that was enough.
Yeah, and then, and he gets in. He breathes in. You shouldn't breathe in.
Yeah, he's authentically out of control in that.
Yeah, yeah. You shouldn't breathe in if you're going into vacuum because you'll create an enormous pressure differential. It will just pop out. You'll die. You've got to exhale. Actually, I think my personal suspicion is I think you'd fall unconscious and die very quickly in vacuum.
Yeah, people. It's not been a lot of testing, actually.
No, I think you'd fall unconscious and die very quickly. I think there'd be some real shocks on the body. But anyway, he manages to get in, and then we've got another amazing scene. It's so packed with amazing scenes, this.
Yeah, we have this very slow, and unlike all of the other murders which have taken place, which are, you know, they're elided, they're seen distantly, or they're told about through indicators, or
except the spaceman, like, grasping for air and tumbling through space.
Yeah, but it happens so fast. He just shoots across the screen, and you see him, like, grasping, and then he's dead. And it's like, whereas this, the death of Hal is going to be in full view, and it's going to happen very slowly.
Happy ending, by the way, in 3001, the sequel to the sequel,
where Hal comes back to life, or what?
He writes the guy who flies off into space a happy ending. He comes back. He's teleported back to Earth in the year 3000, and sort of wanders around a magical. There's a bit when it's like, so computers will have progressed markedly. Yes. This is a data drive for 1 petabyte.
Oh my god.
Yes, in our time we had got to around a terabyte in something that size. Of course there is a limit set by the fundamental laws of matter or something. Anyway, it's fine. There's much more bathos in Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah, so this, again, like, wonderful. I wrote in my notes, like, this sense, you have a very strong... distinctive materiality here, all the injection moldings, and then it's all his
and also he's gone out of the ground. He's in the sort of service part of the ship, which doesn't have gravity.
Yeah, so he's floating.
And he's in his spacesuit. And he goes into the server room, which is really like an IBM thing of the time. It's all sort of, like things that ventilation could go through and stacks. But it's a lot less grubby and neat and smart than contemporary server rooms. And it's in zero gravity. And he goes to the very core, and all the while Hal is saying, "Stop, don't do this, don't do this. I realise I've made some peculiar decisions recently."
The pleading is so bad, and it's like, oh yeah, it's so sad. It's so awful.
And the core of Hal's brain are these immaterial clear acrylic oblongs.
Which slide strangely weightlessly out. The way that they slide is very cleverly.
It's like one of those kitchen cabinet doors where it's push and release, but much more slowly.
It's strange. And some of them go faster than others, and they just sort of, under their own inertia, they
He's got a little slide out on their own. Key, like, and you just keys them out. And the scene is really, it's another really slow... My mind is going. My mind is going.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I can sing you a little song.
And the little song, yeah. So the story with the song is that was the first thing that a synthetically produced voice was programmed to do. But that's not actually the recording that is in the film, which is just a slowed down human voice.
Yeah, a slowed down and very distorted. And he gets rid of all of the non-sort of critical life support elements of Hal, nobbles it completely. And when he's shut the computer down, a video comes up on the monitor, conveniently in front of him, saying,
"This is
a subtext to this mission."
Yeah, have a bit of exposition. Yeah. You've reached a checkpoint. Let's do some exposition, and the exposition is all about the monolith.
We've had first contact with an alien sort of monolith. And there's been strange signals from Jupiter, and you're going out to examine it.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's that. Then we've got a new chapter, which is Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite.
And when they wrote it, it was going to be Saturn, but they decided they couldn't do a good enough Saturn, so they did Jupiter instead.
That's funny. Why do you think Saturn was harder?
It's got rings, debris.
Jupiter's good. They've done a good job of Jupiter. And almost straight away, you see the planets have again aligned.
Aligned. We've got the moons, the Jovian moons. Yeah. No, the Galilean, moons align with the obelisk and the sun.
He's in the pod, and suddenly
And then suddenly something amazing happens and goes on for a very long time.
Yes. I mean, like, there are various points in this film where I can see how... someone might get a bit bored. And
when I was a teenager watching this, I was so bored by this. I found it amazing, but it's like 20 minutes of graphics.
I thought there was something funny, which is that the moment when they align, it becomes a right angle because the monolith is across the axis of all the planets. So it's the divine right angle.
It's the divine right angle. Korba's right. It's,
which creates the wormhole into future transcendent knowledge.
I mean, it's a Mesian tower. Arthur C. Clarke had written it as a tetrahedron, which is proper duff, because tetrahedrons are way less magic than... Right angles are way more magic. Obelisks are way more magic.
Yeah, it was a sort of crystalline tetrahedron. I mean, and Kubrick went with it for a bit, but they realised it didn't work.
No. Obelisk is much better. Obelisk is... Like, there's a reason tombstones are that shape. There's a reason all the towers are that shape. It's a really powerful shape, because it's like the shape of a person, but it's also just like geometry. And then there's... We're going to have a go at describing the light show. He goes into he's like sucked into the space between space or something.
It is amazing. And it still looks amazing. The quality of the effects are really brilliant. It starts off with this kind of, this sort of single point perspective with these smeary kind of gel, very bright color planes above and below, so you're sort of side to side,
and they're whizzing past,
which
you,
you're kind of flying
light,
into
light in space is this sort of psychedelic but technological, like, sort of digital.
So this is created, there's a specific effect called a slit scan, which this is created, which is quite a fascinating bit of technology, and essentially each frame is created with a camera which is looking at a like a tall slit, like 4 feet tall, and the camera, and behind that is a coloured gel which moves a little bit. It's kind of everything is geared so that the relative movement is precisely controlled, and the camera dollies back slowly in with the gearing, and each exposure is one full kind of transit backwards, which takes 60 seconds. So it's very slow. Each frame is a 60 second thing, and what that creates this amazing sort of flowing effect where it's sort of going into the distance. I can't think of anything that looks better than this. I can't think of anything in the era of the digital where someone has done a better job of this.
No, it's incredible. It's incredible. And it has, I mean, that goes on for a while. It does a couple of other things. It does a thing where there are these weird hanging...
Yeah, are those the tetrahedrons? They're not the tetrahedrons, no, are they? Like, they're like dodecahedron
but
things.
But they're not. There's a word for that shape. But it's the one that's like two pyramids on top of each other, square pyramids. And they're having the same sorts of things projected onto them. They really do look like amazing exploding light things.
And there's the oil ones as well, aren't there?
And then there's oil, and there's these...
sort of milky...
Like, they are sort of like oil slides, but they're just 1,000 times better. There are these amazing high definition, slow stuff happening in sort of oil jars, but
yeah, there's this kind of distending,
like in a sort of cloud chamber, drops of color expanding and smearing, but it just looks much better than you've seen that before.
The sliding quality of everything is very uneasy. It's sort of distending. Things are moving, but in this sort of weightless and bending way.
Really short high speeds, that's really slowed down, and it's just, it's like matter falling into a black hole.
Yeah, it's this, you really have this sense, this kind of membrane, this kind of membranous quality of this matter, which I guess is very relativistic, isn't it? That's kind of a thing
it's amazing. It's not, I think. And then there's a bit which does feel a little, the bit that does feel a little bit aged, although it's still pretty amazing, is this footage shot from a plane, which has then been, where the film has been incredibly heavily treated and solarized, where basically, if you want to imagine the effect and you haven't seen it, if you've been on Photoshop and you've taken the hue at various different bits
into a dangerous area,
just like slammed them all over the place, and also slammed like the contrast all over the place,
it's this kind of, yeah, you get these,
I think,
like,
it's mainly footage off the east, or like, which is the one with big rocks, not flat ones. That's West Coast, isn't
it? Yeah,
really?
West Coast of Scotland. Yeah, there is a bit of... There's definitely some of Utah or something like that. There's this kind of ultraviolet mesa. And then, yeah, there's a lot which I can completely believe it's Scotland. But again, and this is actually a thing which would reappear in The Shining, somehow he creates this real sense of horror or foreboding in the aerial where you're going in on something which you can't see. And there's something horrifying
about it. Something that is amazing
about
that also is that it does feel like, you know, the Huygens probe approaching the surface of Titan. That thing of it sort of going slowly down into this, like, weird landscape of strange colours. And it feels like it could be underwater or in some... The colour effect feels like there could be some... You're in the atmosphere of Saturn.
Really, really amazing. And you can see, so this part of the story of the success of this film is said to be like young acid heads getting very into this sequence. And you can see how it
you
would
mean
be...
some of the slightly moderated catastrophic failure of the film?
Yeah. Like... Yeah, I mean, you can see how if you saw this for the first time, it would be unlike anything you'd seen before in your life. So actually, I timed it. It's about 10 minutes. That from the start of the light show to the bedroom is 10 minutes.
And then, this is going to blow the kid's mind. Where the hell does this thing take him to?
It takes him to a bedroom from the Dorchester Hotel.
Is it?
Apparently.
I'll tell you what it's like. It doesn't make me think that. It's really weird. The room is like Rococo, lush interior, except that it's all in grey. And also, it looks like there's slightly more MDF around than you would think. The floor is aluminium profiles and frosted white glass glowing, and then there's all of this Rococo slightly Louis D'Snerf furniture.
Yeah, and it has a sort of sickly greenish cast. Yeah,
and the sound is like really quiet. There's nothing except so that whenever any noise is made, and it's so weird, it's given him like this place, and there's a bathroom with like, you know, all the good bathroom fittings, and there's a huge bedroom and a dining room. Very claustrophobic. And he's walking through in his spacesuit at first, and he's looking around, and then he looks and he sees himself, and he's a bit older, and he's like having lunch with a sort of wine glass and a table at this funny, and then he breaks the glass and he looks on, and he's, you know, he's going through various stages where he's exploring the stage and he's getting older.
He goes through various stages, and there's this very effective thing where the way it's staged, it, I think, is really clever, where he keeps seeing himself as an older person, and then you cut to the older person, and then the younger one is gone. So you kind of, yeah, it's he keeps becoming,
and it's silent, it's wordless, keeps moving completely on. Wordless.
There's something really horrifying. There's a bit late on where he's sitting eating a meal in the corner of the bedroom, and the sound of the cutlery on
the... And
he's
in like a wheelchair as well, but like wheelchair of the 18th century.
Yeah, the kind of cutlery on the plate is so jarring. The design of the sound is so kind of horrifying.
It's really, you hear everything as if you're like a contact microphone on the table. The aging makeup is definitely not just aging makeup, it's definitely horrifying. It's like really, it's a bit of the factor of how it is, but it's not like, it's like he's aging really weirdly. So the last thing that happens is he like smashes a glass, and he sees into the bedroom, and he sees himself looking incredibly, unbelievably old. And then it pans to that, and the obelisk has returned.
Yeah, he sees the dying version of himself in bed, reaching out, and then he is him, and what he's reaching out to is the obelisk at the foot of the bed, standing there like the, you know, the child come to pay its respects.
And we've got the ligeti again, and something is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the bedroom is so weird. The bedroom has a kind of greenish cast, and then the bathroom is sort of bluish, but they're both, it's such an environment of indefinable horror.
Yeah, like, I personally have never found eiderdowns particularly convincing. You know, that thing of the sort of satin edge of the eiderdown and then the turnover. Like, I, for some reason, seem to have grown up in the mid-19th century, where we mainly just had blankets.
I've experienced them. I mean, both my grandparents used to make them like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Where you have, yeah, it's all tucked in.
Yeah, yeah, you're really pinned down, and there's like a sort of, the eiderdown has like a satiny fringe, which some of the blankets have as well, and then you have a folded over sheet, and it's all in sort of shades of goldeny brown. And the tactile quality is like this really loose, puffy quilt of feathers.
There's like an upholstered panel at the head of the bed as well. There's like elliptical upholstered panel behind the head of the dying man.
Yeah. It really feels like there should be bolsters, but there's just one. My mattress wasn't as long as I was, so my head was just supported on bolsters off the end of the bed. All I can say is I must have been a very tolerant child at that stage. It's a really, really, really strange thing to do. It's a really brave, strange thing to do, to have this place. There's no explanation. He's at Jupiter. He goes through this psychedelic light show, and then he's in this place, which is extremely strange.
In some way, time no longer exists, or he exists throughout time, or there's some weird slippage going on in time. But it's not, you don't know what it means.
And what is, I mean, this is definitely a dream. But whose dream is it? Is it an obelisk dream? Is it his dream? It's somehow a sort of merging of like the unconscious of like an alien and him.
And the obelisk is at the foot of the bed, like a kind of prodigal child. Like, you know, it's kind of crept into the room somehow, standing on the carpet. And then we're suddenly seeing the planets again, and the star child.
And then he's a star child floating in outer space. He's like a baby in an amniotic sack, with giant eyes floating through the cosmos, and he sees Earth, and that's the end. And that's that.
So apparently there was a plan, actually, that after the obelisk appeared in the bedroom, there would be aliens who would be indicated in an ambiguous way with some kind of light ray or something like that. And essentially, the reason that didn't happen is because the money ran out at that point and they just had to edit what they had. They weren't allowed to do any more shooting.
That wouldn't have been an improvement.
No, it's good. It's good.
Pretty confident. Because it's so strange. It's so unsettling and weird, the end.
I tend to think he might have taken, even if they had shot it, he might have taken it back out again.
I think he would have ditched it. He had a good sense for that.
Because it's unexplained. It's completely mystical.
I mean, to be honest, the Star Child bit, it works, but it's a bit weird. Like, it's slightly a fluff, I think, the weird baby in space.
It feels a kind of blessed relief to be out of the bedroom. The bedroom is, I mean, of all of, it's so claustrophobic.
It's funny, because you feel at one level it's meant to be, we can do a little bit of discussing what it means for us before we talk about what other people feel, or at least, which is that it feels like you're sort of meant to think this is like a good thing, or that you know, this is a sort of new being that's created, but we've had so much horror. Like, I know it's sort of underground horror, but the environments are so horrid that although it's super cool, you don't feel it's positive. I don't like this. It doesn't feel lifeful and good. It feels like the obelisk doesn't feel like a good force. It feels like a really bad force. What does the obelisk takes us to? It takes us out of Eden into violence. It motivates us to, like, kill. And then it motivates this, it somehow engineers this story where, like, everyone dies through this, like, evolutionary struggle between man and computer. And then it takes him to this weird, horrible place and then turns him into an amniotic sack floating in space.
Yeah, I think the Star Child is meant to be the renewal of mankind, and it's a new birth. It's the potential of.
Yeah, is he like the new gorilla? Is he going to exterminate humanity now?
No, he's going to lead them into a new.
That's not what the gorilla
world.
Did.
No,
that gorilla and his gorilla buddies killed all the other ones and took over.
They just killed enough to make an example, and then they took over.
Well, that's not how evolution works. Evolution works by you've got to be the survivor and they're not there anymore. You obviously don't have to exterminate them all in one go. You can just slowly drive them to extinction. But, like, is that what's going to happen? Because he didn't turn all of the people into
Star Children,
just one of them. I mean, I'm not sure that sort of thing is meant to be definite, but the emotional feeling I get is that it's really bad.
It's the start of the end.
It's like, it feels like Earth has become a dead place and it's the end, you know, the belt, it's like the last judgment. Yeah. And onshore into 1,000 years of heaven on Earth, maybe, but of a slightly harsh kind.
I don't sort of reconnect the Star Child with Earth, really.
But it, like, Earth comes up as this, the end of the film is like Earth coming up and it's the Star Child.
But it's an image of Earth, isn't it? It's not the Earth as kind of reality. For me, it's David Bowman is becoming an idea, isn't he? He's transcending. He's sort of experienced the whole gulf of time. He's become this, like, transcendent glowing baby.
Yeah, it's clear to me that, like, what was going on before doesn't matter anymore. And I'm sort of joking that he's going to go and exterminate humanity.
I think that there is a harshness to it, isn't it? There's the kind of, it's a sort of Buddhist nihilism, isn't it? Of a kind which I think appealed to Clark. You know, that was his bag, ultimately, wasn't it? He went to live in Sri Lanka and was very into that kind of religion, that particular kind of insight.
It's like the progress of modernism is going to continue forever, you know, down the route of alienation. Alienation is going to carry on until we're literally aliens.
I mean, eventually we've got to be, don't we? Things can't stay the same.
But there's lots of different ways they could change, right? It's reaching for that desiccated heaven, isn't it? When actually the qualities of life that are positive are, you know, birth, change, growth.
For me, it's much more about beyond the infinite. It's taking you into the sort of holy terror of beyond time, beyond the infinite, beyond space, whatever that is. But that is an aesthetic experience, really, isn't it? I have trouble connecting it with it's, or the pleasure of it is that it's not connected to my own, to the reality of my own life. It's a thing outside of it which doesn't impinge on it.
The film, though, is about the future of humanity. It's about, like, what happens when we meet something beyond ourselves in the cosmos, like science, religion, or, you know, what happens when this phase is over? The state it portrays man being in before this experience. Well, I mean, there's that bit when you see his daughter, which is, like, really different. But the rest of the world that you see is really... it's had all the life taken out of it, almost.
Well, yeah, it's kind of super infrastructural, isn't it? It's a sort of totally organised, totally and meticulously organised...
Totally alienated. The alienation of human activity from the physical world has become total.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are all these scientists doing underwater research or whatever
it is. You never
see
any of it.
But it is apparently going on.
There's no one's plugging anything in, switching anything on.
Everything just comes out of, it's sort of vended.
No one does anything. No one makes anything. No one makes a cup of tea in this world. Everything is made, and everything is made in a way which just means that it pops out completely made. Nothing is got rid of. Everything disappears. The space station has no bedrooms. The spaceship has no bedrooms. Neither of them have any rooms. They just have places where like, the computer is in a room, but it's just, the whole room is just the computer. All the stuff that we do that isn't talking to each other and controlling, you know, all work has been taken out by machine. You don't pay for things. The money is just deducted magically from your account.
At the same time, I mean, people have also found a kind of utopian potential in this environment which provides for all of your needs. I mean, that's sort of one of the things which is being interrogated in those super studio images, isn't it? That you have this sort of universal infrastructure which gives you everything that you need, and what it means is that you don't need to own anything. You can be a kind of a nomad. In a way, it frees you from all of the kind of baggage and kind of excess of bourgeois life.
You don't need to have any clothes. You certainly don't need to have any pockets to put your phone and keys in.
No, you don't need anything. You can just wander. You can be a wandering poet. Or in those super studio images, a sort of like naked hippie dude lounging on the technological
Cartesian
beach.
Cartesian coordinates, yeah. But with the mountain somehow in the distance.
Yeah. I mean, it's very ambiguous. And people at the time, I think, were... Yeah, on different sides of that tension.
It's funny, I didn't think of this in context of the computer episode, but it is actually.
This is an image of a particular era of the computer, isn't it?
Yeah, it's when the computer is in the basement and you have a terminal and you log into the computer and bid computer time for the process. Yeah. And which I guess, I mean, it's the cloud, but it's different to the cloud, actually.
The infrastructure hasn't sort of dissolved and become placeless. In the era of the cloud, the computer is sort of is kind of co-located between something in Ireland, something in Arizona. It's all over the network, and it kind of is the network.
But also, the interface, our interface is extremely codified by language, or like semiotics or symbol. You know, you have to understand all of these icons and symbols and ways of relationship, which is reaching the complexity of an entire language. To operate with them, we have taught ourselves a language of operating with a machine, which we have also taught a language. But closer to, you know, the stack or whatever, the process name pops up, executes. You see a visual representation of the mathematical task that it's executing. In the server room, there is a board for each of the functions. You know, you take out the board, which is some part of its heuristic circuitry. There are no graphical user interfaces. There are buttons which have specific functions, and there are screens which sort of display specific information with no... Whereas now, yeah, we've got this whole language, which is grubby and irritating and sort of like, Hal is never going to go bah. Like, you're never going to be doing like your slides of Palladian villas and then like a box is going to come up and say like,
You need to register for whatever, like, this terrible management software for the lecture capture program that the university has got, which for some reason requires every user to separately register on some enterprise server somewhere, and which will pop up reliably every like 32 minutes in the middle of the lecture.
I mean, that's we've all done that. HAL won't do that. Like, our computers don't kill you with kindness. They kill you with incompetence, with accident,
with complexity.
Why do you think he went? My suspicion of how he got to this Rococo room is that he loves the 17th century. I mean, it's sort of 18th century interior, isn't it, actually, really?
So, there is apparently an idea that this is the Dorchester Hotel and that it is a hotel room which the character has been to before. That, like many things in the film, is something which is no longer really present, but is the sort of original genesis of the idea.
Well, the taking out of the explication is what makes it, is something which makes the film dramatically more powerful. Because causation is kind of naff, isn't it? It's like,
yeah, because that then tips your hand that, oh, it's this sort of mental construct which Dave is in, and he's in his own mind or something.
Which you totally sort of know.
You do kind of know, but actually,
yeah, to me it feels very much like it's a mind. It's a projection created by the obelisk.
Yeah, this is sort of what a room looks like, isn't
it? I felt like before I read anything, and in fact, before I watched the film again, based on my teenage watching experience, is that it had made like a lab box for him.
Yeah, yeah, it's got a construct.
And that it's so weird is a tool of making explicit how strange the mind, if such a thing is, of the obelisk is. And it could be that there isn't a species, it's just that there is obelisk, which actually is like a shiny void.
Yeah, this absolute vacuum of meaning.
It's also, though, the last extension of what's happened to humanity, which is that all of the stuff has been abstracted. Here it has been, even existence has been abstracted into, yeah, as you say, the Buddhist vision. First, we take away labour, then we take away thinking, and eventually we annihilate the ego and can cease to be, or be this eternally abstract
nothingness. It's a symbol of timelessness, ineffability, the void, the vacuum of meaning, the incomprehensible, the absolute, you know. Something which is beyond understanding, and to visualize that in a way which is not cheesy, I think is one of the most effective. It's shiny and it's very black, and you can't see anything when you look at it straight on. We've done an hour and 20. Do you think we should? Do you think? Have you got a couple of other things to talk about, or should we bring it almost to a close?
Maybe we should just say, well, I think you've got the key stuff, but we might waffle on for more, and then that'll go into the bonus content. All right.
Oh, well, so beyond the we leave you. Yeah, beyond the infinite. Beyond the infinite.
Oh, this is going to be great music. And then we've recorded an outro already, haven't we?
An outro? I don't think we have.
Okay.
But
remember that Patreon? Yeah. I think we've all told you why.
Yeah. So, well, we have... Yeah, we have said actually that what we're going to do on the bonus. So thanks a lot for listening.
A special thanks to Patreon subscribers and reviewers and people who have sent us emails.
Yes.
We've had a few very nice ones.
We're recording all of this in one go, so we won't know your thoughts on the first half of the episode, but do send them to us anyway.
And we are listening to people's and gathering together things that people want us to do shows on. Not going to guarantee we're going to do them. And also, don't be disheartened if it takes ages. Our turnaround for podcasts is like a quarter this one I was thinking about like in February, so you'll get a sense of
We'll get there eventually, but yeah, we'd love to know what you'd like to hear.
Also,
for main episodes, for bonuses, for anything.
Bonuses. Give us your thoughts. That sort of thing. And thank you very much for listening.
Yes, thank you.
Kind and nice of you.